At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're going to spend some time on banks today, the general health thereof, and the risks they still present, too. Also, the witching hour for cable news and travel toys for summertime. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At AllyBank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 14th of July. Great, as always, to have you with us. There was a report out this morning from the Congressional Oversight Panel. That's the group that's in charge of keeping an eye on the TARP, the bank bailout of a year and a half ago. In a nutshell, it goes a little something like this. The $700 billion that was allotted to keep the financial industry up and running did a bang-up job taking care of the big banks, those too-big-to-fail ones. Smaller firms, not quite as systemically important. TARP didn't really do much for them. They're having a hard time making quarterly dividend payments, let alone paying the money back. And in fact, the report says that the TARP may actually lead to more takeovers and failures of small banks. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Today's report says one in seven small banks that took money in the bailout has already missed a dividend payment to the government, and those dividends will only get more expensive as time goes on. Elizabeth Warren chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel that wrote the report. She says all this means some small banks will likely be swallowed up or shut down.
When the smaller banks are weak, their lending remains constricted. And these are the banks that disproportionately lend to small businesses.
And since small businesses are a key engine of economic growth, she warns the demise of small banks could stymie the recovery. But not everyone is so concerned. Andy Stapp, an analyst at B. Riley, admits that small banks are an important resource for local communities.
But a lot of these are being taken over by larger community banks. So, you know, in that regard, I don't think you lose anything.
Bart Narder agrees. He heads the banking group at Celent. He says losing one in seven small banks wouldn't be the end of the world.
Banks of under $100 million in assets simply aren't of a viable size anymore.
Narder says small banks have been losing deposits to the mega banks for decades, long before there were TARP dividend payments.
In the good old days, you had a branch and you had an ATM and you were done. Now you need internet banking, you need mobile banking. You have all this regulation you have to comply with. So small banks have been disappearing at a very fast rate in any case. Nothing to do with TARP.
Still, Elizabeth Warren's panel warns fewer small banks will concentrate even more power at the large Wall Street institutions. She says that could set us up for more financial crises. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
If small banks are in trouble, all indications point to the big guys doing pretty well. We'll learn just how well tomorrow morning when J.P. Morgan starts the quarterly banking profit parade. But, you know, small bank failures and booming business at the likes of J.P. Morgan are only half the story. A new report out from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York says the financial reform bill that's in Congress now barely touches on a key part of the financial industry, what's called shadow banking. Our senior editor and wizard of the Marketplace Whiteboard, Patty Hirsch, is here. Hello, Patty.
How you doing?
I'm well. First things first, I suppose we need a definition. Shadow banking is?
Well, shadow banking is banking. I mean, shadow banks are organizations that lend money to people, just like traditional banks do. So the difference between traditional banks and shadow banks in that respect is minimal. There's no difference between them. The difference comes, however, when you talk about who actually puts their money into these banks, because banks obviously take money in and then lend money out. In a traditional bank, that money comes in from depositors. In a shadow bank, in the shadow banking system, that money comes from investors. That's not depositors, not people like you and I, but investors who want to invest in that company.
Are there names of entities within the shadow banking world that we would recognize?
Oh, sure. Two classics are Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns.
Oh,
for example.
I know them. Yeah.
I mean, those big investment banks were part of the shadow banking system. The people that put money into Lehman and Bear weren't depositors like you and I. They were regular investors.
Give me a sense of scale here, though. I mean, how big is this shadow banking system?
Well, it's enormous. Back in 2008, two-thirds of the loans that were lent out to Americans were lent by the shadow banking system. Today, it lends about $16 trillion to Americans, and that's just over half of the amount of money that's lent out to Americans altogether.
$16 trillion is, just for the record, bigger than the whole American economy.
There you go.
You know, you say shadow banking, and it implies something nefarious, not necessarily on the up and up.
Well, it's not that it's not on the up and up, but the difference is that, you know, traditional banks are very, very tightly regulated. They've been in existence for a long time, and regulators have really got a grip of these things. Shadow banks haven't been around that long, or the shadow banking system hasn't been in existence that long, so the regulations are a lot looser, and they're a lot freer to do things like, you know, borrow pots of money and invest them in potentially risky securities. The other thing is that traditional banks have this thing called deposit insurance. So if things go wrong with a traditional bank, you're going to get your money back, or most of it, if you're protected. Shadow banks don't have that kind of protection. So if there's a hint of trouble, investors in those organizations are going to run for the hills. And that can kill a bank overnight, as it did with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. And because the banking system we now know is so interconnected, that can bring the whole system down with it.
All right. So there's this report from the New York Fed that I talked about up at the top. What are we doing about this banking system, the shadow banking system?
Well, the way the New York Fed sees it, we're in danger of not doing enough. You know, the report says that the shadow banking system got this huge bailout that brought it out into the daylight for a while. But now those banks have paid that money back. They've escaped back into the shadows and possibly out of the reach of the regulators. So what the New York Fed says is what needs to happen is the people who actually craft the specific rules, they need to recognize that shadow banks do the same thing as traditional banks. They lend to consumers, they lend to Americans, and therefore they should be treated the same way. Unfortunately, given what we've seen with the auto lenders, it looks like that's really not going to happen, and that's putting us in danger of creating the same risky lending environment that we had before the crash.
Well, expand on that a little bit, because the Senate's going to vote tomorrow on this big financial overhaul bill. What's in there that might at least control the shadow banks?
Well, we still really don't know that much, because a lot of these rules actually have to be written in detail. You know, the bill gives us the general outline, but the regulators have to sit down and actually craft the very specific regulations, which themselves are going to be enormous as the bill is. So until that is done, until the regulators have actually decided what is a bank, in inverted commas, as it's referred to in the bill, we're not going to know that.
We're still trying to figure out what a bank is.
In a way, yes, that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Our senior editor, Patty Hirsch, you know him best through his series of whiteboard explainers of every size, shape, and texture, including one, as it happens, on the shadow banking system. You can see it on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Patty, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
Okay, so banks are making money, as we just said. So, too, is Intel. The chipmaker reported its best quarterly earnings in 10 years yesterday. Revenue was way up. Profit margins were up. So was its stock today in what was a fairly tame session overall. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that good news for Intel may also be a good sign for the rest of us.
During the dark days of the Great Recession, back when companies couldn't get credit and were hoarding cash, corporate technology budgets took a beating. So for the past few years, many workers have been making do with desktop machines that are, well,
very well seasoned, if you will.
Craig Ellis is an analyst at Kerrison Company. Ellis says Intel's blockbuster earnings mean large corporations and even some small businesses are buying again, investing big in computing upgrades.
This is very important because capital spending had been the real bright spot of the economy.
Lynn Reeser is president of the National Association of Business Economists. Research says corporate spending on PCs and servers had been rising for a while.
But we were beginning to fear that business confidence had dropped very sizably and that businesses would not keep spending.
In the past few months, financial turmoil in Europe and some pretty weak economic reports here had economists and investors talking about a double-dip recession this summer. But now economists and analysts like Ellis are looking ahead, waiting to see if other high-tech firms like Microsoft and HP can imitate Intel.
We're just heading into the reporting season for U.S. companies, so there'll be a lot of signs over the next 2 to 3 weeks.
And Ellis says if earnings remain this strong, any references to double dips this summer should be confined to ice cream cones and swimming pools. From Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
A quick update now on a story we did Monday about the future of the GlaxoSmithKline diabetes drug Avandia. An FDA advisory panel voted today to keep it on the market. They could still recommend stiff warnings and scary labeling if they so choose. As I said, things were a bit undecided on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There's still no progress to report on the new cap that BP put on the wellhead the other day. But even when the leak is finally sealed off, there will still be millions of gallons of oil floating around in the Gulf. A whole boatload of dispersant, too. A couple of boatloads, probably. That's the stuff that's supposed to break up the oil and make it easier to handle. Government seafood inspectors have been testing what fishing is allowed for oil contamination, but nobody's been checking for dispersant levels. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has our story.
Government scientists test seafood the way a lot of us figure out whether or not something's okay to eat. They sniff it.
It's truly a sniff versus the long gasp of air.
Steve Wilson heads NOAA's seafood testing program. Wilson says the feds also run fish through chemical tests, making sure they've not been exposed to oil. But they're not testing for dispersants. BP has poured nearly 1.8 million gallons of the stuff into the ocean.
The FDA and the EPA have generally determined that dispersants are not toxic or are not of concern in the seafood during consumption.
The FDA says dispersant doesn't concentrate in the edible parts of fish or penetrate fish gills or bodies. Wilson says the department is developing dispersant tests just in case.
This is something we have needed to do, but we've been so gripped with the oil itself, and now we're taking a second look.
Susan Shaw is a scientist at the Marine Environmental Research Institute. She says dispersed oil is more toxic than oil or dispersant alone. The ingredients in dispersant include heavy metals and arsenic, to name a few. The confusion is tough on Yule Smith. He heads up the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board. He's confident the government's doing a good job, but
there's some questions around the dispersants, which everybody has concerns about, and we want to see those as much testing as we possibly can to make sure those concerns are put to ease.
There's a lot at stake for the government to get its testing right. Smith says the Louisiana seafood business is worth $2.4 billion. Nothing to sniff at. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
If you're watching what you eat, well, not to worry. The FDA says dispersants probably won't wind up in edible bits of fish. But if you do just have to know, we've got a list of dispersant ingredients on our website. It's marketplace.org. There are fundamentally two schools of thought about summer travel and staying wired. There are the people who just want to unplug everything, the cell phone, the iPod, the computer, and be free. And there are those who take the opportunity to bring along the latest and greatest travel gear with them. That, of course, made us think of Kevin Pereira from G4 Television. Not only does he travel all the time, he jets about with all the gadgets that he can get his hands on. So we asked him to come by and share some of his favorites. Kevin, I got to tell you, it's been a while.
Has been a while. How are you?
I'm well. And just in time for summer vacation, you are here to give us the travel tips and the gadgets and all that good stuff that you play with all summer. What's in the travel bag?
Yeah, I have a smattering of toys to bring with you on any road trip. Right. First of all, being the first 3D handheld camera. This is the Fujifilm Finepix Real 3D, the W1.
So 3D camera.
Yeah, so as you can see, if you slide it down to power it up, and you'll see that there's actually two lenses on it. So it's snapping an image for the left, snapping an image for the right eye, and it puts them both together, and you can actually view the image on the back without needing any glasses.
Three, two, beautiful.
Here it is.
All right, you know what? That's making my brain hurt because it's all fuzzy. Oh, but you can't actually. Oh, wait. No, look. So if you turn it, it's a little bit like those kids' stick-ons where you turn it one way and it's one picture and you turn it the other way,
yeah,
it's another picture.
Lenticular.
Yeah, the lenticular. Right, exactly.
Right. So
That is sort of what's happening
here. It's not supposed to need to be like that. The idea is that you're supposed to look in the middle, and Fujifilm's technology beams an image to the left eye, beams an image to the right eye, and you put the parallax effect, which is what gives you that 3D effect, together yourself. Some people either go wow or ow. And
I'm an ow.
You're an ow guy.
So this is not quite ready for prime time, but it's a cute idea. Now, can you print this too?
Fujifilm, on through their website, they'll allow you to print out the sort of lenticular version of that photo, so you can shift between the left and the right.
How much is this bad boy going to set me back?
Right now, they're about $550.
All right. Well, something in the audio realm is next, I gather.
Yeah. I'm showing off these earbuds by JH Audio. They'd probably slap me if I called them earbuds, because that sounds like something you get at an impulse buy at the checkout stand. Yeah. These are custom molded in-ear monitors. So I'll hand you a pair here.
So I will slip off my big professional radio studio headphone things and slide these in.
So now these obviously will not be molded to your ear canals.
I can't even tell which one's right and which one's left.
I can give you some audio through this if you want to hear.
Yeah. Let's give it a whack.
What's on Kai's playlist these days? If you were to smack shuffle on your iTunes, what would pop up?
You know, a lot of Bare Naked Ladies right now, actually.
Bare Naked Ladies.
Yeah, what can tell you?
I'm going to give you the first album that popped up.
All right, turn it up a little bit. Kevin, I can't hear it, man.
There you go.
Someone's got a nightclub in their head right now.
This is a lot of volume on these things. It's really loud.
That's the point.
They're really comfortable. They're nice. I'm going to venture a guess that they're more than I can afford.
Before I get to the price, I have to sell you on the technology, of course.
All right, go ahead.
You know, normal earbuds have a single driver, which is the speaker that produces the sound. And so whenever the bass drum hits, that speaker punches, and it has to relax before it can force the next sound out.
Right.
These earbuds here have 16 drivers inside of them. They go anywhere from $300 all the way to $1,100.
It's a lot for like listening
to a
ton. Podcast.
But if you're serious about your music, or if you're a musician, these double as inner monitors for when you're performing, and they're a must for anybody who's into music.
All right, there you go. The last item. We're a little handicapped here because we don't have Wi-Fi in this studio.
So we're a little left out. This is the Sony Dash. This is a personal internet viewer. They're billing it as.
What does that mean?
It's basically a fancy. I brought you a thing called a Chumby.
Yeah,
I remember. Long time ago. This is based off the Chumby platform. So it's basically a widget-ready internet device, which means it has a touchscreen. It can run thousands of applications that do everything from check the weather, display cooking recipes, show you the traffic, allow you to view all your friends' photos from Flickr, or see Twitter updates.
So put it on the counter in the kitchen and
kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, living room. That's sort of the approach to a device like this.
Once again, what's it going to cost me?
200 bones.
Really?
Then you plug your $1,000 earbuds into it, and it sounds like a symphony. It's all it takes.
Kevin Pereira, G4 Television, attack of the show. Kevin, as always, good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
I learn something every time you come to the studio, man. Coming up.
You want to do what? Tear down a freeway? Oh, they thought I was nuts.
Cities consider deconstruction. But first, let's do the numbers. Bad retail sales knocked some of the wind out of Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials gained less than 0.1%, just 3 points, closed at 10,366. The NASDAQ edged up 0.3%, 7 points, 2249 at the bell. The S&P 500 moved the other way, though, sliding about 0.1%, 1 point, 1,094 there. Retailers were down almost across the board. JCPenney rolled down 0.8%. Walmart stumbled 0.3%. Saks laddered down 0.1%. Nordstrom unzipped 0.75%. Those good numbers from Intel helped juice tech stocks a bit today. The semiconductor leader chipped up 1.75% today. IBM sparked up 0.1%. Microsoft burned 1% higher. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3% on the nose. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. By the new Harvard Business Review. The July-August issue is on newsstands now, featuring an in-depth interview with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the producer price index for June. A Senate Appropriations Subcommittee examines the use of dispersants in response to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And next month, Social Security will reach its 75th anniversary. A House Ways and Means Subcommittee discusses the role the program plays in the well-being of American workers and their families. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If the name Piers Morgan meant nothing to you until this morning, I know how you feel. Mr. Morgan is apparently in line to take Larry King's job on CNN. Morgan is a Brit, best known here as the mean judge on the NBC show America's Got Talent. CNN is hoping Morgan's got some, too. Talent, that is. Because the 9 p.m. slot that Larry King has called home for the past 25 years is apparently a crucial one for cable news. Marketplace's Eve Troeh explains why.
When TV executives look at their nightly ratings, media consultant Michael Castanguera says there's one shape they don't want to see, a hammock.
Each program is hung between another program. Well, if that hammock sags too low, tells you the viewers went away and they may not come back.
Castanguera says Larry King Live started to droop between CNN's 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. shows.
There was a dip to Larry King, and then a slight rise back up to Anderson Cooper.
King's been losing because of stiff competition from other cable news networks. But the other channels actually put their strongest hosts in that slot because of King. Bill Carroll is with Katz Television Group. He says for decades, King was the man to beat.
Larry became the one constant and the most important place on CNN. And as a result, over time, that's become the key time period where the real battle and the real recognition comes.
Kat says other networks fragmented King's audience, intentionally programming against his down-the-middle style.
Each of the major competition have staked out a different approach, more personality-driven and more driven by a political point of view.
King's more staid manner may be disappearing from cable news, but Kat says the legacy of 9 p.m. as the cable news primetime will remain. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Vice President Joe Biden took the wraps off the administration's most recent report card on the economic stimulus package today. The White House says, and this number is probably subject to political interpretation, that it has created roughly 3 million jobs in the past year or so. A lot of that work is being done on infrastructure, building and fixing bridges and highways. Dozens of cities around the country have just the opposite in mind, though. They want to tear down parts of some freeways. From WNYC in New York City, Andrea Bernstein reports.
Near the lower tip of Manhattan, Michael Sorkin is standing just yards from the East River and Brooklyn Bridge, but you can barely see them, so he looks up.
We see traffic that is in at least three different levels. There's the FDR Drive, there's an interchange to get people onto the Brooklyn Bridge that's flying over the FDR Drive, and then flying over that is the Brooklyn Bridge.
Sorkin is an architect and head of urban design at City College of New York. He's drawn up a different blueprint for this patch of Manhattan. Tear down a section of the elevated highway, the on-ramps, and cloverleafs.
You would see that one of the most beautiful architectural achievements in the history of consciousness, the Brooklyn Bridge.
There'd be parks, plazas, restaurants.
You would see boats cruising by.
Sorkin drew up these designs as part of an international exhibition by the group Institute for Transportation Development Policy. As crazy as it sounds, the idea of tearing down highways in dense urban areas is ricocheting around the country. Cleveland is planning to convert a lakefront expressway to a boulevard by 2012, and Seattle is moving to tear down a double-deck highway by that same year.
I think it's ridiculous.
Back in New York, teacher Carmen Gant was walking her dogs near the FDR Drive. Her reaction to a proposed teardown is typical.
People are going to drive into Manhattan regardless, so why not make as many roads or possibilities to get into Manhattan as possible?
It turns out that New York actually tore down an elevated highway in the 1970s. Sam Schwartz was the chief engineer for the New York City Department of Transportation then.
And people panicked. They thought that was Armageddon.
The highway had begun to crumble, so the city dismantled 60 blocks and replaced it with a regular street.
After that, we had trouble tracing about one-third of the people. Transit went up. We had the same number of people coming in, but they weren't coming in by cars.
San Francisco also lost freeways in the 1989 earthquake. Some years later, the San Francisco Chronicle wrote a story about it. The headline, "Traffic Planners Baffled by Success. No Central Freeway, No Gridlock, and No Explanation." Engineers found that traffic volume had dropped from 93,000 cars a day to 45,000. But what happens in a city where there isn't a lot of public transit?
You want to do what? Tear down a freeway? Oh, they thought I was nuts.
John Norquist was mayor of Milwaukee from 1988 to 2002. He wanted to take down the Park East Freeway, which ran through downtown.
A lot of people realized it was ugly and all that, but they thought, well, what would you do with the 40,000 cars a day that use it?
Norquist is now the president of the Congress of New Urbanism, a group that promotes denser communities. He says in 2002, when he tore down the highway, downtown congestion didn't jump. Instead, it dispersed all around city streets, and business activity in the area went up.
I don't think there'd be a lot of people say, oh, Milwaukee was a great place till that freeway got torn down.
Skeptics remain, like Robert Buzz Paswell. He says goods and services must be able to move through cities.
You just can't take out a link in a highway and expect nothing to happen.
Paswell is an engineer who's interim president of City College of New York. He says without city highways, some people will find it harder to get around. New York officials haven't endorsed any plans to dismantle the southern tip of the FDR Drive. But around the country, mayors and governors are eyeing urban highway teardowns as the road to development, not congestion. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Andrea's story was part of the Transportation Nation Public Radio project. You can hear more and you can see what it might look like near the Brooklyn Bridge if the FDR Drive does someday go away on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note this afternoon. You might have heard that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is trying to convince the White House to make nice with businesses. The chamber is lobbying the Obama administration to cut back on regulations and corporate taxes. But a survey the chamber released earlier this week shows the group may have some deeper problems. Far fewer of us care for capitalism than we used to. It does still have majority support in this country, to be sure, 57% in favor. But still, 43% not in favor of capitalism? Think about that for a second. And as you do, bear in mind that that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow up 3 points, less than a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq up 7 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 gave it up to the tune of 1 point, about a tenth of 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, we could nag you to save energy, sure, but it doesn't always work.
I think the word conservation, energy conservation, for some people may bring to mind an image of, you know, a scowling Jimmy Carter sitting in the White House with a sweater and telling us all to shiver and turn the lights off.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen.
That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.